Okay, we're coming in here 10 lines from the bottom on Dalet Amud Bet. The Gemara here is discussing the statement of Rav Anan, who says that if an individual is mumar l'avodah zarah, that his shechita is still acceptable. And the Gemara is trying to find evidence of the fact that that is true. And the Gemara is going to Achav, who we worshipped avodah zarah, according to the Navi, Achav v'siyato. Achav and his men, Chazinan Be'ud Ovdei Avodat Kochavim Havu, Rashi tells us, that they worshipped the Avodah Zarah, Ubin Nevela Lo Ashkan Be'ud Pakre. But we don't find they have any issues with Nevela, or that they engage in the practice of eating Nevela. Ve'ika the Meimar, the Yitzra the Avodat Kochavim Taku Falayu. Rashi says, maybe the Yitzra for Avodah Zarah was very strong. Ve'oshafat Tzadik Gamur Haya. On the other hand, Yoshafat, who's the Melech of Yehuda, at the time that Achav is the Melech of Israel, Yoshafat is a complete tzaddik. Now they have alliances between them, whereby Yoshafat aids Achav in battle, and so the Gemara is trying to understand that relationship between them. There's also a familial relationship, because Yoshafat's son marries the daughter of Achav. So there's a union between the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom at that time, not just because of the fact that they were aligned and allied in terms of warfare, but also because they created familial overlap, which made it that there was a very close connection between the northern and southern kingdoms. So now what the Gemara is trying to establish is that Yoshafat, when he interacts or has connections with Achav, that he's partaking of whatever Achav is making up there, or preparing up there. Yoshafat is a tzaddik and is assumed to be eating kosher. We assume then that whatever Achav was doing was satisfactory for him. And that's why the Gemara is trying to prove from their interaction the story, which includes the fact that he brings them up to the northern side. Vayizbach lo Achav tzonu bakar larov, v'la'am asher imo, vayisateu lalot ramot gilad. And he convinces him, or he sways him, to go up to Ramot Gilad. Ramot Gilad is going to be the undoing of Achav, because he already has a nevuah from Michayahu ben Imlah, the Navi Lashem, that he's going to die if he goes up to Ramot Gilad. He will not succeed in the battle of Ramot Gilad. And Yoshafat right now is being convinced to join the battle. And he did that through preparing a meal and a large feast in which he invited Yoshafat and his men to. So the Gemara is now proposing different options as to how it was possible that someone reliable did the shechita, and it wasn't done by the men of Achav, which would approve that someone who's a mumar l'avodah zarah can do shechita. So the Gemara says, 10 lines from the bottom on Dalet Amud Bet, Gavrei d'Achav Abu Malu. Maybe Achav's men, Achav's entourage, were ksherim. Lo sagadatva, you wouldn't think that, dichtiv. Because you have the pasuk in Mishlei, it says, Moshe makshiv advar sheker, kol mishertav rishayim. So you have a ruler who follows the way of falsehoods or lives a life of sheker, then his servants, his entourage are rishayim. So there's a correlation between the quality of the leader and the people that surround that leader. V'delma gavrei d'Yoshafat nami lo avu malu. Maybe the people that were with Yoshafat were not good people. Because we said before that Ovadia, who happens to be a Navi Emet, we know he is someone who is against the workings of Izebel in the northern kingdom to worship the Baal. He's a Navi that, first of all, hides the Nevi'im from Izebel, the kosher Nevi'im. He hides them in the caves and sustains them after Izebel goes to kill all the Nevi'im besides the Nevi'i Baal. In addition, we know that he interacts with Eliyahu and Navi. Because when Eliyahu disappears, Achav asks Ovadia to go find him, and Ovadia finally finds Eliyahu and brings him to Achav. So we know that Ovadia is someone who's kasher. So the Gemara suggests that maybe he did the shechita. Gemara said that would not suffice because the number of people eating were too many, and he couldn't check sufficient amount of kosher meat in order to have this feast and everybody have kosher meat. So Gemara now is saying, okay, maybe Achav's men were okay. The answer to that is, the entourage reflects the character of the king, and since Achav is no good, his men are no good. Now the Gemara goes the other way and says, maybe Yoshafat's men were no good. Zaboach gavrei d'Achav, achol gavrei d'Yoshafat. So the entourage of Achav, they did shechita, which the entourage of Yoshafat ate. Zaboach avadya, achal Yoshafat. On the other hand, the Shechita of Ovadia, Yehoshaphat partook of. And if Yehoshaphat's men are no good, then Ovadia could have done enough Shechita to take care of Yehoshaphat. Forget about the rest of his entourage who didn't care about the Kashrut. And then that way you solve the problem, because now Yehoshaphat, who's the only one we're worried about, did have someone who was shechting for him that was kasher. When it says, Lo sagadatko, midi moshel makshiv al dvar sheker, ko mishartav yishayim, al dvar emet, mishartav tzadikim. It's just the inverse of the pasuk in Mishlei. If you have a bad leader, then his entourage is bad. You have a good leader, then his entourage is going to be good. So we would naturally assume, unless we had evidence to the contrary, that those people that are accompanying Yehoshaphat are kshirim, just like Yehoshaphat was. V'dilma zavoach gavrei de'achav achal achav v'gavrei. Zavoach gavrei de'yoshaphat achal yoshaphat v'gavrei. Let's just assume that they brought their own food. Meaning that the individuals of Achav, when they did the preparations of the food, that's what Achav and his entourage ate. Yoshaphat's men did their preparations, and then Yoshaphat and his men ate from those preparations. And in that way, those that ate from Achav's food were the men of Achav and Achav himself. And those that ate from Yoshaphat's food were Yoshaphat and his entourage, and then you wouldn't have a problem. It says, Lo ava maflig nafshe minei. He wouldn't have separated himself so much. I mean, the whole point of this meal, as the Pasuk testifies in Divrei Yamim, was Vayisateyu la'alot ramot gilad. It's a way to convince him, it's a way to encourage him to join in the alliance to go fight in Ramot Gilad against Moab. And so, if they came and they were eating their separate meals, that by definition creates a separation, a distinction between them that wouldn't allow for this Vayisateyu, to convince him and to encourage him to join the battle. There has to be some sort of overlap. And this is something that we saw as a recurring theme in Avodah Zarah, part of the Gzeirot, to the Takanot Chachamim, to stop from Bishalakom and Stam Yenom, or to ensure that individuals don't, on a social basis, interact and have meals together, because there's a certain amount of closeness, affinity, that grows from breaking bread together. And so, if here all they did was come up and have their separate meals and their separate entourages, then it wouldn't create the affinity that Achav was looking for, or the convincing nature in order to encourage Yehoshaphat to join in the battle. So the Gemara says, Midola, how do you know that? How do you know that their friendship or their social interaction was one of closeness? Ileima bidichtiv, is it because what it says in Melachim Aleph, Achav says to Yehoshaphat, Vayomer l'Shaphat, Hatelech iti l'milchama Ramot Gilad. After Achav makes the request of Yehoshaphat to join him in the battle, Yehoshaphat answers, Chamoni kamocha, ke'ami ke'amecha. I am like you, and my nation is like your nation. So it makes it sound like this is really an alliance of brotherhood, similar to what Ruth says to Naomi in Megillat Ruth. When you make a statement like this, this is a huge commitment in a brotherhood. Elamiata, if that's the way you're going to explain the pasuk, it's a little difficult, because it says afterwards, Kisusai kisusecha. My horses are like your horses. Achanami. So now you're going to say the same thing there. So clearly there you're not speaking about social interaction, or that the horses now have an affinity for each other, have a brotherhood for each other. What it means is, Elama dahavi asusecha dahavi asusai. Rather, the expression means, whatever happens to your horses will happen to my horses. So, Hakanami, and similarly, my dahavi alecha vilavai amcha dahavi alai vilavai ami. So the similar expression then would be, just like by the susim it's this way, so too, whatever happens to you and to your nation will happen to me and my nation, because we are going to be in the battle together as allies. Or in essence, he's saying that we're going to join the battle on equal footing. And whatever happens to you will happen to me. I mean, he's pledging an alliance or even allegiance of sorts to Achav, but he's not saying that there's any sort of friendship over here or commonality between them. He's just saying that we will face the battle together and equally. And so that whatever happens to your horses will happen to my horses. Whatever happens to your people will happen to my people. Whatever happens to you will happen to me. Not because there's some sort of kinship here, but rather because we're going to join and we're going to be in the battle together. Ela medacha. From here. Umelech Yisrael v'yoshafat melech Yehuda yoshvim ish al kiso melubashim bigadim bigoren petach shar shomron. Shomron's the capital city of the northern kingdom. And so here they are sitting together, milubashim, dressed in their clothing. Sounds like they are adorned in their royal garb, and that they are now sitting in the entranceway to Shomron, sitting in the entranceway, or being in the entranceway usually was a public meeting of importance. We find that in Megillat Rut, when Boaz wants to secure for himself Rut, he has to go to the Shaira Ir in order to deal with the issues. We also know by Abraham and Marat HaMachpelah that it's all done Petach HaShar. All of these locations indicate an area of importance or where issues or matters were discussed. And similarly over here, when they're in Shar Shomron, that means it's a huge public display. It's something where there is a meeting of importance. And here you have the two kings adorned in their royal garb sitting in Shar Shomron. But it says over there that it was a Goren. It was a threshing area. My Goren. Ilem a Goren mamash. If you think it's really a threshing area by the entranceway, Atu Shar Shomron Goren Hava, is really Shar Shomron a Goren, a threshing area? Now, you can say this from two perspectives. One is a halachic perspective, which is you're not allowed to thresh near the city. We know that from the Gemara and Baba Batra, that you have to move a certain amount of distance from the city, because otherwise, when you do the threshing and the winnowing in the threshing area, then the chaff floats away and lands on everything that's there and ruins gardens or other things that are nearby. So we encourage you to give a certain amount of distance between the threshing areas and the city itself. So that's from a halachic standpoint. Separately, just from a practical standpoint, if Shar Shomron was the major entrance to the city, and it was also a place where they had these public meetings, it would be unlikely that it would be a threshing floor where they were hanging out. The reason to hang out in a threshing floor is just usually because it's an area that has been cleared, and it's usually a flat plain that is open. That's why many times when they meet, like for the Beit Midrash, and for other things, they meet in a Goren. A Goren is just a large, open area that's flat. So that makes sense, but over here that it's in Shar Shomron, it wouldn't make so much sense that they were meeting in Shar Shomron by a Goren. So Ella Ki Goren. It's not literally a Goren, but like a Goren. Tetznan. Sanhedrin Aitake Chatzi Goren Agula Kadeshoim Zeh. That the Sanhedrin used to sit in a semicircle, like a Goren. Chatzi Goren Agula. A Goren that was made circular. The shape of the Goren was usually circular. So they use that as the paradigmatic circle by which they say Chatzi Goren. Half of that would be a semicircle. It was a way to describe it. But they only did halfway. As Rashi explains over here, that is so anybody who was arguing, interacting, and trying to present their position, you would be able to face that individual. If you sat in a row, then one person on one end and on the other end would not see each other. But if you sit in a semicircle, no matter who is speaking, everyone else there can see him and can participate in the discussion. Now, Rashi says they don't make it into a full circle, which would have worked just as well, because then everybody's facing each other, everybody can see each other, is because you need a way to enter and exit. So you need to leave an open space for entering and exiting. I would have suggested that you also need a space for the Balei Din, or those that are presenting before the Sanhedrin to stand, so you wouldn't have it be a circle, because then you'd have your back to some of them. If you have a semicircle, then the people that are presenting face everyone that's there. So he says the same thing over here. They were sitting around in a manner by which everyone could see each other, the kings could see each other, the entourages could see each other. So that was the nature of their camaraderie. Rashi says over here, this shows that there was Yoshvim Bechiba. They were sitting together in kinship, ubereyut, and friendship, aguda achat, and as a single unit or a single union, kis Sanhedrin, shein choshtim zeh. Just like the Sanhedrin are trusting partners in their job as the Sanhedrin, so too the indications here are not simply about the way they sat, but in the nature that they sat. It's more than just they sat in this formation. It means that that formation is an indication of a certain amount of closeness and trustworthiness with each other. So here is the evidence of the fact that they did interact in such a manner. And we see now that Yoshafat's participating or partaking of the food that was provided by Achav, so that would be evidence to Rabbanan's position that we saw that Yisrael Mumar Levdat Kochavim is Mutar Le'achol Mishchitato. So Leima Misayile, let us find other evidence to this fact. V'ha Orvim, Me'vim Lo Lechem Ubasar Ba'boker V'lechem Ubasar Ba'arev. It's a reference to Eliyahu Navi when he secludes himself in the desert, and he's hanging out at what Chazal considered to be Har Sinai, and he's in a cave there, and God says that we'll provide him whatever sustenance he needs in that location, and that was done by the Orvim. The ravens used to bring him bread and meat in the morning and bread and meat in the evening. They provided him with the meals that he needed in order to live. Where were the Orvim sourcing their food for Elio? So he says it was coming from the palace of Achav. So the Gemara sees in that an indication that Achav's house was kasher because the fact that the food was being provided from Achav's palace to Elio and Avi. Gemara answers, Alpia Dibur Shiny. Wait a minute. Over there, God is the one saying that this is what I'm going to provide for you. Because it says, Vet Orvim Tziviti Lechal Kalecha. Elio is not going to question the kashrut of the food because God said, this is food's going to be provided for you. I'm going to sustain you over here. So when God sustains him over there, he's not asking where it's sourced from. It was Hashem who was providing it. And when Hashem provides it, you don't need a kashrut stamp on it. Whatever God brings is going to be fine. Whether it came from the house of Achav or anywhere else, it doesn't really matter. God said, I'm going to sustain you. The Baalei Tosafot asked on this, and what was the Havamina of the other opinion? Everybody knows God said to Eliyahu HaNavi, I will provide for you, I will take care of you. And so what was the Havamina that was evidence? In addition, he asks, Tikshei Hadam Arav, Basar Shinita Lema Ma'ayin, Asur. What about also the principle that we know from Rav, which is that meat that is not visible is considered to be Asur. If it leaves your eyesight, I mean, without a chotam, without any indications of its kashrut, if it leaves the watchful eye of a mashkiach or the individual is eating it, it's no longer meat that is kasher. When the Orvim take off with the food, it's clear that nobody's watching it, nobody's seeing the food anymore. Even in the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, when it discussed this, said that when the bird flew off the meat and the person ate it, it was because he had his eye on the bird the whole time and he saw where the meat was, he saw where it was dropped. So he knew exactly what it was, and it wasn't Basar Shinita Lema Ma'ayin. So over here, how do you deal with that? It says, Yesh Lamar, Zeh Haya Yodea Shel Sumech Apia Dibur, the La Mishel of Dei Kochavim Kamaiti. The only guarantee, or the only evidence that is here, is that the fact that it wasn't coming from non-Jews. If God said he's providing it, God's basically giving certification that it's not coming from non-Jews, that it's coming from Jews. Aval Lo Sakadatzva Shabbat Dibur Latira Isur Shechita Tabachim Dachal. But who would say that God's instruction would then say that the meat of Achav is okay? So that's the Havamina, or that's the one brings this as a proof, is thinking. It's not Basar Shnita Lemayayin, because God certifies that it's not from a goy. The other hand, who says that God would certify non-kosher meat in order for him to eat it if it came from a Jew? So that would be the question. If it's coming from the palace of Achav, and God's certifying it, must be kosher meat. And the Gemara answers that no, Apia Dibur Shaini. Even if possibly it was non-kosher meat, that would be okay because God said, I'm providing you this meat. And whatever meat it is that God provides, that you eat, and you don't ask questions about the kashrut. Later on today's daf, we'll discuss whether that something like this is acceptable, meaning just because God says it, does that mean that consuming non-kosher is okay, or God would allow one to consume non-kosher food, and we'll see that later on in the daf. So my Orvim, so the question of how correlated this is with the previous Gemara, whether this is just a non sequitur, a sidebar, because we discussed the Orvim here, so we're just going to discuss about the Orvim in general, or is this a continuation of the questioning and saying, how do you know that the Orvim over here were ravens? Maybe they weren't ravens, and therefore the meat was certified because it was brought by individuals rather than birds. So that could be the nature of the question. Or it could be like other midrashim, where we discussed Orvim, let us discuss the other issues. Maybe these were different types of Orvim, nothing to do with the kashrut issue. So my Orvim, Amar Avina, Orvim Mamash. They were ravens. Amalevader Bar Minyume, Vidilma Trey Gavre, Davi Shemayu Orvim. Maybe their names were Orev and Orev. So these two individuals who were called Orev were bringing him the meat or providing him his food. Milok Tiv, Vayerguet Orev, Bitsur Orev, Ed Ze'ev, Vyekev Ze'ev. In Shoftim, when it discusses about the battles, it says over there that they killed, the name of the king was Orev and Ze'ev. So you have these individuals whose names are animals. Not just their surnames, but their first names were those of animals. And so there was someone known as Orev and there was someone known as Ze'ev. So we see that it was a name. It's not far-fetched to suggest that Orev would have been the name of an individual. So Amarlei says, what type of ridiculous situation is that? In Rame Milta, the Tarvayo of Shemai Orvim? just happened to be that the two guys that were going to provide for Eliyahu, both of them, their names were Orev. Now, Orev is already an unusual name. The fact they had to bring a pasuk to prove to you that there is such a name already indicates that it's not your average name. And then to say you got two guys with the same name, that doesn't make a lot of sense. But Dilma, Shem Mikomam. Maybe it wasn't that their primary name was Orev, but rather that was the name of their location. That's where they came from. Meloktiv Varam Yatsu Gidudim Vaishbum Eretz Yisrael Na'arak Tana. So in the time of Elisha in Melachim Bet, Aram is plaguing the northern kingdom. They basically attacked them with terrorist type of tactics. And one of those was Aram Yatsu Gidudim. They went out in their troop formations. Vaishbum Eretz Yisrael Na'arak Tana. They took into captivity a young girl from the northern kingdom. V'kashalan, karila nara, v'karila ktana. Wait a minute, why does it give two descriptors to this young girl? Ktana would indicate that she was not of age. Nara would indicate that she was of age. So how do you have a descriptor to as a girl, both a nara and a ktana at the same time? So Amar Abdat, ktana d'minoran. She was a young girl, she was a minor, but she came from Neuran. And then, as Tosfot points out, that we have Sukkim that indicate that this is a name of a place, and he quotes from Divrei Yamim, the same thing over here. Orvim is not their name, but rather the description of where they came from. Where it says, Imkein Orvim Mibayilei. It should have two yuds in it. People from Orev would be Orvim. The fact that it says Orvim and not Orvim is an indication that it's not about the location they came from. Rather, it was either their name, which would be something far-fetched, or more likely, it's really Orvim, which are ravens. Now, the Baal Tosfot would say that it's a little precarious to say that the fact that it doesn't say Orvim is an indication that they didn't come from Orev. Because he says we find many times in the Torah that it says Ivrim, Mitzrim. It doesn't say Mitzriim, or Ivriim, it says Ivriim and Mitzrim, and it uses it with a single yud. So the validists would say there is a difference. By Ivriim and Mitzrim, there's nothing you can make a mistake. There's no alternate way to read the word that would have given you another meaning. Over here, by Orvim, there is a possibility that you would read it as Orvim instead of Orviim, and therefore the additional yud would be necessary over here to prevent the mistake from being made. So if you really wanted to say they were from Orev, you couldn't just say Ivrim, Mitzrim. You would have to say Orvim with the additional yud in order to indicate that, because otherwise you would misread it as Orvim, which is the way that we're reading it, that it really means ravens and not somebody from the place of Orev. Lema Mesayile. Let's say this is evidence to what Rav Hanan said. Hakol shochtim vafilu kuti, vafilu arel, vafilu Yisrael mumar. All these individuals are entitled to do shchita, even shchita lechatchila. That's a kuti, an arel, some without a brit milah, and Yisrael mumar. Hay arel hechidami. What exactly is the circumstance surrounding this arel? We had this exact same bright that was quoted yesterday, and the Gemara is doing the same thing over here. Ilema shemetu echav machmat milah, that his brothers died when they got a brit milah. Hay Yisrael mal yehu. Then he's a full-fledged Yisrael. The reason he's not doing it is because it's pikuach nefesh. And pikuach nefesh is dochel kol haTorah kula. The fact that he's an arel here doesn't detract from his status as a Jew. It's because it's too dangerous from get a brit milah. El pshita mumar la'arelut. It's an individual who doesn't believe in brit milah. Rashi yesterday said mivait b'mitzvah zu. He doesn't care about the mitzvah. He kicks the mitzvah off. The Rambam, when he quotes it, says that the guy is scared of the pain of getting a brit milah. So he's scared of brit milah, or because of the pain of the brit milah, he does not engage in brit milah. So whatever the reason is, he's a mumar le'erilut. He lets some other factor override the necessity for him to get a brit milah. Therefore he's a mumar le'erilut. Ema seifa, filu Yisrael mumar. Hechidami. So then, once you say that that is speaking about a mumar le'erilut, then what does Yisrael mumar mean in the next part of the Braita? Im mumar le'davar echad, haynu mumar le'erilut. If he's mumar from one of the sins in the Torah, that's no different than being a mumar to the sin of erilut. And erilut is a pretty significant sin. So if you're going to already cover it under that rubric of mumar le'erilut, what do you need in another part of the Braita to tell you about other sins? Elalab mumar labudat kochavim. It must be that it's something that's on a different plane or a different level completely, which is someone's a mumar labudat zara. Ukeder Ravanan, and then it'd be exactly like Ravanan. What the Brayta is now saying is, Akuti, a Mumar Larilut, and a Mumar Le'avodah Zarah are all Kshirim for Shechita. It says, lo, no, maybe someone's a Mumar Le'avodah Zarah is not qualified for Shechita. Damar Mar, Chamura, Avodat Kochavim. Avodat Kochavim is a serious violation, Shekola Koferba, Kemodeh B'chola Torah Kula. Rashi quoted this formulation yesterday, but if you look in the sheet that Mekubetzet, he reverses the formulation, Chamura Avodat Kochavim, Shekol HaModeh Ba, Kekofer B'chola Torah Kula. Over here, you'd want the negative formulation, which is, anyone who worships Avodah Zarah is as if he has rejected the whole Torah. You know, that the way that it's formulated is someone who rejects Avodah Zarah is as if he has accepted the entirety of the Torah. We're really looking for the negative formulation, which is someone who partakes or participates in Avodah Zarah is as if he's rejected the Kol HaTorah Kula. So Avodah Zarah is in a different league. Ela Mumar Loto Davar. It's rather that he's a Mumar L'Shechita. Uche de Rova. And like Rova, which we saw in yesterday's daf, the Gemara brought this Braita as a possible proof to Rova. Despite the fact that he's a mumar le'ochel nevelot b'te'avon, we don't assume that he's going to do iser when he has an opportunity to do heter. We're not going to say that he views it as heter gamor. We're going to say that when he has a choice, he'll make the choice to do the heter over the isur. And then the Gemara rejected it as a proof for Rava, because over there it says, no, the mumar over here is not a mumar le'ochel davar, not mumar le'velot b'te'avon, but rather it's a mumar le'avodah zarah. What you see the Gemara doing is being doche from both sides. The Braita clearly has to be explained in one of two ways. Either Mumar le'avodah zarah or Mumar le'ochel nevelot le'te'avon. But what we do is in each circumstance, when we're trying to bring it as a proof to Rava, we'll say, no, we'll explain the Braita as Mumar le'avodah zarah, not Mumar le'ochel nevelot le'te'avon. When we come to Ravanan, we're not going to explain it as Mumar le'avodah zarah, we're going to explain it as a Mumar le'ochel nevelot le'te'avon. So we'll use each one to be docha, the possibility that the Braita is substantive proof to their position. Not since the Braita can be read in one of two ways, you don't have any evidence that it should be read the way that proves that position. So therefore the Braita is not a proof. What the Braita is a proof to is that one of the two is correct, because the Braita has to be read like one of the two. Which of those two we don't know, and therefore the Braita is not evidence to either one of those positions individually. Jointly, it's evidence to one of the two, but independently, it's not evidence to either of them. Meitavei. So Gemara says, we tried to bring more evidence to the fact that Ravana and Amar Shmuel's position is correct. Now the Gemara moves on to another Braita, which is Mikem. Adam ki rakiv Mikem korban la'ashem. It's the beginning of Vayikra. Person is going to bring a korban. Mikem means from amongst you. From amongst you, the Gemara always views as it, v'lo kulchem. Not all of you. From amongst you means not everyone can do this, only some of you can. Lotziyat a mumar. To tell you that a mumar cannot bring a korban. Mikem, bachem chilakti, velo bu'umot. When it says mikem, it means amongst you. The parshiyat, the beginning of Vayikra, which is speaking about korbanot, is to Bnei Yisrael. Within Bnei Yisrael, I make a distinction between those that can and those that cannot. That is not true by the umot, by the goyim. It doesn't matter what their position is or what their background is. We accept the korban no matter what. There is no such distinction. And that is because a goy is only included from the pasuk of ish, which is found in Parshat Emor, not here in Parshat Vayikra. And given that, the inclusion of an achri is not subject to the miut of mikem. Mikem is female in an instance where it's only Jews that are bringing the korbanot. That's why the Gemara draws a distinction between Jews, where are some that do and some that don't bring, versus the Goyim, where it's a universal policy. Mina Beima. So again, there, the words Mina Beima are extraneous, because it says right afterwards, Mina Bakaru Mina Tzon. It tells you which Beima. So why is there Mina Beima? The Gemara, in other places, has alternate drushas for Mina Beima. It comes to exclude Roveya, Nirba. The Gemara has all sorts of miutim that come from it. But here the Gemara learns mina beima levi bnei adam shedomim lebeima. It comes to include people who act like behemot, not necessarily in their behaviors, but in their lack of adherence to mitzvot, which is Rashi says over here she'ein mekayimim et mitzvot. They don't keep the mitzvot. So it's a way to relate to people who are not necessarily adhering to the Torah. Mikan amru mikablim korbanot miposhei Yisrael. From here we know that you accept korbanot from people who are sinners. Kadesh yachzru ben b'tshuva. In order to encourage them to do tshuva. chutz, with the exception of min amumar, u'minasechet ayayin, u'michalel shabbatot b'farhesia. So there are three exceptions to the rule for people from whom we don't accept korbanot. That is a mumar, minasechet ayayin l'avodah zarah, and michalel shabbat b'farhesia. So the latter two you can understand because those are mitzvot that are shkulot keneged kol haTorah. Avodah Zarah and Shabbat are considered to be some of the primary mitzvot, the cardinal mitzvot of the Torah. And so if you violate those, we're not going to accept your korbanot. The question is that mumar appears now in this braita three times. It says mikem, to exclude a mumar. Then it says mina beima, to include poshei Yisrael. And then you have chutz mina mumar. So you have three different sections of this braita, and some seem to include the mumar, some seem to exclude the mumar, and there are multiple mumarim that are mentioned here. Ha gufakasha. The Gemara says it's internally inconsistent. Amarta mikem alo kuchem, it says from amongst you, and not all of you, lotziyata mumar. Vahadar tani, right afterwards you say mikablim korbanot mi poshe Yisrael, that we accept from poshe Yisrael. Ha lokasha, that's not a problem. Reisha mumar lochol haTorah kula. The first case there is a case where you're mumar lechol haTorah kula. That's why we don't accept your korban. What exactly the definition of mumar lechol haTorah kula is subject to machloket rishonim and achronim, but that literally means he violates all the mitzvot of Torah, including Shabbat and Avodah Zarah. Or does that mean excluding Shabbat and Avodah Zarah? Or does that mean that he just doesn't do rov mitzvot, not all the mitzvot? Or does that mean that someone just in general doesn't care about mitzvot? It's not about any particular mitzvah or violation of majority of mitzvot. It's just that he doesn't accept the mitzvot in general. So any one of those could be the definition of what it means to be mumar lechol haTorah kula. Mitziyata, the middle section, the part about the poshei Yisrael, is mumar ledavar echad. That's when you're a violator wantonly of one sin. Obviously we're not speaking about someone's doing the hachis, but rather someone who's doing it l'te'avon, ema seifa. So then what about the latter part of the braita? It says, chutz min ha-mumar, u'minasech yainu mechalel shabbat v'esya. Ha-mumar hechidami. What mumar do you have left? You've already covered the two types of mumarim. You have mumar l'chol haTorah kula, and mumar l'mitzvah achat. So then what's the mumar in the third section of the braita? Im mumar l'chol haTorah kula in a reisha. That's covered by the reisha. Im mumar l'davar achat. Kasha mitziyoto, then it would be the opposite of the mitziyoto. It's saying here no, and then the mitziyoto says yes. Elalav achi kamar. Must be this. Chutz min ha-mumar l'nasech yayin u'lachalel shabbatot b'farhesya. The mumar there is not a separate category, but rather it says mumar colon. What is that? Which mumar are we speaking about? L'nasech et ha-yayin u'lachalel shabbatot b'farhesya. There's a certain type of mumar that is in a distinct category. There's mumar lechol haTorah kula, who's clearly problematic. There's mumar l'avera achat, who is acceptable. We allow him to bring korbanot. But there are some mumarim l'avera achat that are so significant that they're like kol haTorah kula, and that is nesech yayin, avodah zarah, and Shabbat. Alma, from this you would conclude, mumar l'avodat kochavim, have a mumar lechol haTorah kula. Someone who's a mumar l'avodah zarah is like a mumar l'chol haTorah kula. If that's the case, then he clearly will be disqualified from doing shechita. If that's the case, tiyufta the Rav Hanan, tiyufta. That would be a strong refutation of that position of Rav Hanan, because this braita seemingly indicates that if you're a mumar l'avodah zarah, then you're disqualified from being a korban. And assuming that you're disqualified from being a korban also means that you're disqualified from doing shechita. And so even though this braita is not speaking about the issue of shechita, what's clear here is that when you are a mumar l'avodah zarah, you're a mumar l'chol haTorah kula. And if that's the case, that would disqualify you from doing shechita, because if you're a mumar l'chol haTorah kula, it's clear that shechita is not acceptable. Now Rashi explains over here why these are so significant. As far as Menasech Yana Avodah Zarah, it's pretty clear. We already brought the Memra before, but one who worships Avodah Zarah is a denier of the whole Torah. Someone who engages in Avodah Zarah is complete and wholesale rejection of God by taking up another God. So there it's not a question as to why that person is disqualified. By Shabbat and Parhesia, so Rashi over here explains that, Hai Tana Chamir Le Shabbat Kavudat Kochavim. He thinks that violations or violators of Shabbat are on par with worshiping Avodah Zarah. Tovet v'dat kochavim kofer b'kodesh baruch hu. Someone who worships Avodah Zarah denies God. V'amechalel Shabbat kofer b'ma'asav. Someone who denies Shabbat or violates the Shabbat is a denier in God's work. U'me'id sheker shelo Shabbat b'kodesh baruch hu ma'aseh b'reishit. And he testifies falsely that God did not rest in his creation of the world on the seventh day. We rest on the seventh day as evidence of the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world in 6 days and then rested on the seventh day. Someone who violates Shabbat is testifying to the contrary. We say that our keeping of Shabbat is edut. It's testimony of the fact that God created the world and rested on the seventh day. So that means the opposite. Someone who violates the Shabbat clearly contradicts that view and is denying that God was the creator of the world and that God created the world in 6 days and then rested on the seventh day. The Rambam goes further to say that it's Oti. It is the covenant. It is the item that binds between Bnei Yisrael and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And someone who violates that oath or violates that covenant has breached the relationship between them and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So that's why it's so significant. But that's why Shabbat is on par with Avodah Zarah. And we find the psukim that are in the Parashat Shlach, all the mitzvot that are brought there, are mitzvot that are considered to be connected to Kol HaTorah Kula, including Tzitzit, Avodah Zarah, and Shabbat. All three of those are the topics at the end of Parashat Shlach. So it's not surprising that the Braita puts these into a category of Mumar L'Kol HaTorah Kula. Now, Tosfot over here points out that Kedei She'yachzeru Bahem B'tshuva, the fact that we allow you to bring korbanot when you're a posheya, why is it that we allow you to do this? Rashi over here defines a posheya as someone who, mashma mezidim, someone who intentionally violates the mitzvot HaTorah. And that's what type of mumar we're speaking about here. So we're not just speaking about someone who sinned, someone may have did something by accident, someone who's doing this intentionally, bim mezid, that's the type of person we're speaking about that is entitled to being a korban. Now the Tosfot says, lav taima dekra kodorish. The Gemara here is not doresh taima kodorwa, the reason of the pasuk. Elonotein tam the davar, it's the other way around. We have a locha, and they're trying to explain the reasoning behind the locha. Because it can work in one of two ways. It can work in the manner where we know the halacha, and now we're trying to explain the tam, which is what the Rambam and the Ramban and many Mefreshei Mikra do in the Torah. We have a mitzvah, we have established principles, laws that are associated with that mitzvah, give the reasons for it, try to explain it. On the other hand, we have the sheet of Rabbi Shimon throughout Shas, who says that Dorshim time of the Kra. Rabbi Shimon, when he says Dorshim time of the Kra, it doesn't mean just, oh, let's figure out the reason for the mitzvah. Rather, he sees the reason for the mitzvah as being halachically impactful. And that means that, for instance, in the case of the mashkon, where you have to return it and you have to be careful because she's an almana, and it will give her a bad name, a matzor shekhenim, that's only true when we're speaking about a poor woman who you'd have to return the item to her every day because she needs it. But if you're dealing with a wealthy almana who doesn't need the item, then taking a mashkon from her is not a problem. That's the way Rabbi Shimon views it. Rabbi Shimon says, the explanation or the reasoning behind the mitzvah has normative impact. And so over there, he believes only a poor almanah is it restricted from taking a mashkon from, not a wealthy almanah. On the other hand, the Chachamim say, no, the mitzvah says in the Torah, don't take a mashkon from almanah. Period. There's nothing to discuss. You want to discuss what the reasons are behind the mitzvah? Fine. But despite the reasons, they don't have any normative impact. It's going to be true for almanot across the board. So Tosfot says over here, the same thing. Don't think that they're coming to explain the reason behind the pasuk. Why are some people excluded and some people not excluded? The reason a mumar is excluded is because we don't think he's going to do tshuva, or we don't think he's going to do the right thing. So somebody's only a mumar ledavar achad, where he is more likely to engage in tshuva, and this would encourage him to do tshuva. Therefore, we should allow him to bring a korban. That's not what's being said over here, because that would be the reason giving normative impact on it. Rather, the halacha is, a mumar l'chol HaTorah Kula can't bring it. Mumar l'davar achad can bring it. Okay, now why is that the case? Why would you distinguish between them? And that's the reason being brought in the Braita. So Tosfot is very clear that he thinks that it's not time to kura d'garish, and no tein tam l'davar. They're explaining the reason behind it. The kamar, the mumar l'davar achad b'kal yachzor b'tshuva. Since it's more likely that he will be returning tshuva, kach mekablim mehem kadesh yachzeru. That's why the Torah permitted them to bring their korbanot, and that's why we accept it from them. The other Rishonim will see this as being more normative and say that this really is the reason. Where it says, mehachanafka, we learned this din from here, meaning the din that we don't accept a korban from a mumar. We learned it from the pasuk you just quoted. Mehachanafka, we learned it from the psukim that are found in Vayikra with regards to the chatad. It says, me'am aretz. As Rashi puts over here, me'am aretz v'lo kol ha'am. Not everyone brings it. In the same mem that modifies in the beginning, says that from amongst them you bring it. Prat the mumar. That excludes the mumar. B'Shem Ben Yossi Omer Mishum Rabbi Shimon Asher Lo Tasena Bishkaga Ve'ashem. Someone does something that they are restricted in doing unintentionally, Vashem, and now they are guilty of doing this wrongdoing. And then the pasuk continues according to Rashi, Ohoda Lav Chatato Asher Chata. And then he becomes aware of the sin that he did, Ve'vi Ashamo. And then he brings the Asham, he brings the Korban Chatat for his violation. Rabbi Shimon says about this, Hashav Midiato may be Korban Al Shigigato. Someone who returns and then rejects that action that he took before, that wrongdoing that he engaged in, then he brings a Korban Al Shigigato. Enu Shav Midiato, someone who does not return, someone who doesn't back away from it, Enu Mivi Korban Al Shigigato, does not bring a Korban Al Shigigato. So you can read it very simply, which is that if the person does tshuva, he can bring a korban. Person doesn't do tshuva, he can't bring a korban. That'd be the simplest way to read it. Rashi reads it, and based on the fact that he brings the remainder of the pasuk to tell you that ashav me'ediato means someone who, had he been informed about the avera, would not have engaged in the avera, he's allowed to bring a korban. Meaning, had I warned you beforehand that you were about to do something wrong, you'd say, oh my goodness, and you would have desisted from it. That person is allowed to bring a korban. Someone, if you had informed them anyway, would have continued to do what they're doing and ignored you. That's the equivalent of a mezid. That's equivalent of someone who's intentional and has no interest in doing the right thing. But that means that even if he does the bishogeg, he does it accidentally, we're not letting him bring a korban, because had the situation been that he knew the knowledge, he would have done it anyway. It's a fluke that he did it unintentionally. Had he known the information, he would have done it intentionally as well. And so therefore he's not granted the rights of bringing a korban bishogeg. Barminan, my benayu. What's the nafkamina between these two reasoning? Both of them say that a mumar is excluded from bringing a korban. So Amar Rav Amnuna, mumar lechol chelev, bevi korban al adam, ike benayu. There's a person who eats chelev wantonly. He doesn't care, he doesn't keep the mitzvah of chelev, but he went ahead and he drank blood. So now that's also a violation, but he drank the blood unintentionally. That is the difference between them. The difference would be, according to Rabbi Shimon, who says that had you been informed about the information, you would have changed your mind. Over here, had you been informed it was blood, you would have backed away from it. And so therefore, it would have been fine for you to bring a korban in this case. According to the Tana Kama, who says, if you're a mumar, you're no longer entitled to bring a korban. Over here, you're a mumar l'chelef, so too you are classified as, quote-unquote, a mumar l'dam, even though that's not true. But because you're a mumar in one area, you're no longer entitled to bring a korban b'chatat. That would be the machloka between them. The Baal Yei Tosafot over here asks a question, Tema, my kamar. What is the question of the Gemara over here? The Braita that we brought before said if you are mumar l'kol haTorah kula, then you can't bring a korban. Or if you're mumar l'avodah zarah, if you're mumar l'shabbat, l'chalel shabbat for Frasya, can't bring a korban. Now we're saying, why did you learn it from there? We have another Braita that teaches you the same information. Based on what the Gemara is saying now, the Braita are not parallel at all. The Braita over here is speaking about someone who's a mumar to one item, and the Braita before is speaking about someone who's a mumar l'tara kula. So that's a clear difference between them. How do you bring this Braita as an alternative to the other Braita when it's a totally different mumar that we're speaking about over here? So the Rabbeinu Tam gives two answers to that. The Faresh Rabbeinu Tam, to mumar l'chol chelev, hainu mumar l'chol l'tara kula chutz midam. A mumar l'chelev is the same thing as saying mumar l'kol haTorah kula. Kedashkan shekolel kol chatot b'chlal chatat chelev. What the Baal Yei Tosafot are pointing out is a phenomenon that we see in the Gemara and other places, is that whenever the Gemara wants to speak about a stam chatat, a regular chatat, it calls it chatat chelev. So a chatat chelev doesn't mean literally that it's a chatat of chelev. Chatat chelev is the paradigmatic chatat. When we learned this in the Gemara in Zvachim, we brought two reasons over there as to why that might be the case. Either because it was the most common error. It was something that happened most frequently. It was the most frequent chatat that was brought, because it's easy to mix up between chelev and shuman, and therefore people violated it on the most regular basis. Of all violations, this was the most common unintentional violation that required a chatat, was chelev. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that chelev is the first one that's mentioned, or the first sin that's mentioned with regards to this issue of the chatat, because the psukim by the korbanot mention chelev and dam all the time, including juxtaposed to the korban achatat in Parshat Tzav. And for that reason, we associate the stam korban chatat with a chatat chelev. So now the Rabbeinu Tam now extrapolates and then says, when it said chatat chelev over here, it didn't really mean chelev. Men chatat chelev means the generic chatat. Or in other words, you're a mumar lekol atzarot kula, with the exception of dam. The only thing that you keep is dam. You don't drink dam, that's the only one you keep. Now we will have a question. If by mistake you didn't drink dam, what's your din? According to Rabbi Shimon, bring a korban. Had you known about it, you wouldn't have violated. According to the Tanakhama, you're a mumar lekol atzarot kula. Doesn't matter that you keep dam. Dam is an exception to the rule. It's not your rule, and your rule is that you're a mumar lekol atzarot kula. But in that way, it would be a question on the previous braita, because now we're speaking about mumar lekol atzarot kula. But then you would conclude if it was a mumar ledavar echad, you would bring a korban, because mumar ledavar echad is not mumar lekol atzarot kula, similar to what we saw in the previous braita. V'od yesh lomar, v'davka b'chelev v'dam pligei. The machloket over here between the Tanakhama and Rabbi Shimon is only in the area of chelev and dam. The fishem shavin, they are on an equal plane. Sheish be karet b'shnehem, they're both violations that have a chiyuv karet. Volim the gvoa, and they're normally put on the mizbeach, and instead you're eating them. V'nemru b'lav echad, and the Torah prescribes them in a single lav. Ko chelev chodam lo tochelu. So the dam and chelev are put together. They're like partner sins. They are joined together. They're mentioned numerous times together. They also have the same genre. They are things that are asur bikaret, things that normally ended up in the mizbech, and now instead by chulin you're eating them when it's restricted. So therefore, the Tanakhama savila mumar loto davar kilu mumar ledam atzmo. When you're mumar lechelev, you're automatically mumar ledam. Because chelev and dam are partner sins. So if you violate chelev, we also assume that you are a mumar lidam. And so why is this guy not drinking blood? If you told him he wouldn't drink the blood, that's only because he doesn't have any desire to drink the blood. It's disgusting to him. That's why he doesn't drink it. Had it not been for that, he would have eaten it just like he eats chelev. This person clearly doesn't care about the mitzvot of Torah. The only thing that drives him is his own personal needs. And over here, he's disgusted by blood. That's why he's not partaking in the blood, because the Torah said so. He's not doing it because he doesn't want to. And therefore, the Tanakham says, if you're a mumar lechelev, you're automatically a mumar ledam. Aval, mumar lechad mishar yisurim, shita, that may be korban al ledam. But if you were a mumar from any other yisur, then it's clear that you would bring on the dam. So it's unique to chelev. Ulu Rabbi Shimon, afilu mumar lechol chelev, may be korban al ledam. Whereas Rabbi Shimon is saying that if you're a mumar lechelev, you can bring on the dam. They're separate entities, they're separate korbanot, they're silos, and you keep them separate. If you're a violator in one, doesn't mean you're a violator in the other. But that narrows their machloka to chelev and dam, but that shows you that anywhere else in the Torah, if it was a single mumarla, a single item, then you would be permitted. And again, we saw that in the previous braita. It's only mumarla Torah kula that's restricted. Mumarla davar achad is not restricted. So this braita we're saying, mumarla davar achad is not restricted. Only chelev and dam have this unique relationship, and that's why they influence each other. Anywhere else, mumarla davar achad would not be mumarla kol Torah kula. But if you were mumar lechol atzarot kula, it's clear from here that you would be restricted. So that would be the overlap with the previous braita. The second thing that the Baita Tosfot will deal with is the shita of Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Shimon says, "Is hashav mi yudiyato." Someone who does tshuva, someone, according to Rashi, who would have made a different decision had they had the information. Or according to others, just simply that once you're informed, you regret doing that action. So then, why do you need a pasuk to teach you that? Bali does what say, Tema, Matsari Kralim A8, Ainu Shamiya Diotovo, maybe Risho. The guy remains a sinner, have a Zevach Rishaim Toeva. The Zevach Rishaim is disgusting. God doesn't want korbanot from people who are sinners and people continue to sin. So if you are steadfast in your wrongdoing and in your ways, then why do I need a pasuk to tell me we don't accept your korban? We won't accept your korban because it's Zevach Rishaim Toeva. That you're a sinner who is unwilling or unwavering in your sin, we're not going to accept a korban from you. So he says, Eish lomar, deitzrich le'eched echazar b'tshuva achar kach, that he does tshuva much later on. U'b'shash achal lo yashav mi'idiyato. But at the time that he ate, it wouldn't have made a difference. So at the time that he ate the chelev, had you informed him about it, he would have said, I don't care, I'm going to do it anyway. Later on in life, he becomes a baal tshuva, and then he regrets having done it, now he wants to bring a korban for it. Is he entitled to bring a korban for that? If it was simply about Zevach Rishayim Toeva, at this point he can bring it. He's no longer a Rasha. He's no longer steadfast in his ways. You can bring a korban to bring kapara for his sin. But if you have the posuk now, that says, let's look back at the time that he did the sin. Would it have been influential had he had the information at the time that he did the sin? The answer is no. he would have violated it anyway. So now you're precluded from being in the Korban, even though you're not a Rasha anymore, even though you're doing Tshuva. So Tosfot says, that's what Rabbi Shimon's Pasuk teaches you, that not only do we have to test you right now as to where your allegiances lie, but we have to look back at the time that the sin was committed. Wouldn't the information have made any difference back then? If it wouldn't have made a difference, even now you're about Tshuva now, you can't bring Kapara for that sin, because that sin was not really a Shogeg. It was just a fluke that it was a Shogeg, because you didn't have the information. Had you had the information, you would have done it intentionally anyway, and that's not called the Shogeg, according to Rabbi Shimon. So now the Gemara says, we need two brightos, or the two sources here, because chada b'chatat, b'chada b'olah. The one that is written over here, Ma'am Aretz, is the psukim that are found by the Korban Chatat, and the pasuk of Mikem and Min HaBeima is found by the Korban Olah at the beginning of Sefer Vayikra. So b'tzricha, you need both of them. D'yashmina and a chatat mishum d'l'chaparahu. A chatat that comes for kapara. And the kapara, we're not going to let you get kapara when you're a wanton violator. That doesn't make sense. Avalola doronu emalakabomine. Onola, it's just a donation, it's a gift. So let us accept the gift. He's not looking for atonement, so let him bring a gift, let him bring a korban. Viashmin and ola, if you told me that he was restricted from ola, mishum dolav chiyuvo. That's because it's a voluntary offering. That's why he's restricted in bringing it. Avachatat chiyuvo emalakabomine. A chatat, which is an obligation in the Torah to bring the chatat, maybe we would have to accept it from him. And since it's a chovah, Rashi notes that we don't want chote niskar, that a sinner should benefit. If we exempt him from bringing the korban, then he makes out better because he doesn't have to pay for the korban. Tzricha, that's why we need both of them. We need both of them to teach you that in both instances, a mumar, the davar echad, is restricted from bringing that korban, for example, that item. And a mumar l'chol haTorah kula is restricted from bringing korbanot in general. And again, we won't accept any korban from him while he's a wanton violator. That's whether it's an ola or whether it's a chatat. V'chol eichad ektiv beima griutai. The braita makes an assumption when it says mina beima. A beima is a negative correlation, which is that saying that these are poshei Yisrael. These are the sinners of Israel that act like behemot. Behemoth in the sense that they are void of any mitzvot. They don't keep any of the mitzvot. So that's a very negative interpretation of behemah in the pasuk. And the Gemara says, is the word behemah, when it appears in the pasukim, always indicative of something negative? How did you know that mina behemah there was something negative? V'haktif, don't we have the pasuk, damu behemah toshi Hashem? That God will save man and animal. So there you see Yeshua for behemah. That sounds like it's a more positive reading of the word Behema. It doesn't sound like Poshe Yisrael over there. It sounds like something where Hashem takes care of man and animal. That's a much more positive statement. And what is the representation of Behema over there? Rabbi Yehuda Merav says these are people who are Rumim Bedat. Rashi says over here that they are naked in their understanding, which is that they are like Adam HaRishon. They've got such clear vision, clear understanding. They're like on the status or the level of Adam HaRishon, but they make themselves or they act like animals, meaning that they don't show off. They don't flaunt their intelligence or their great understanding. Another say kibeima means that they do without thought, without question. They're loyal to their master, like behemoth are loyal to their masters, and therefore, despite their tremendous intelligence or understanding, they still follow Hashem in a more pashut way, which is pure allegiance and unwavering emunah in Hashem. And that's what it means, kebeimah. That's a very positive read of the word behemah, saying that it represents people who are humble and have humility, versus the behemah that you're speaking about in the Pasuk Vayikra. You're telling me it means people are poshei Yisrael, that are void of mitzvot. So, hatam k'tiv adam u'behemah. Hachak behemah l'chude k'tiv. Wait, there's a big difference. Over there, it juxtaposes adam and behemah. So in that case, just like adam is a positive statement, we're going to say the behemah associated with that adam is also a positive statement and refers to people who are humble, who have humility. On the other hand, the behemah that's found in the beginning of Vayikra is just mina behemah. Adam is not present there. I mean, the pasuk starts, adam ki yakim mikem korban Hashem, but the adam and the behemah are not associated with each other, they're not juxtaposed. So then when the behemah is standalone, then we're going to view it in a more negative light. So now the Gemara challenges a newfound explanation, which is, whenever Adam and Behemah are juxtaposed, we view Behemah in a positive light. V'aktiv, doesn't it say in this parak in Yirmiyahu, which might be familiar to you because it's the Kol Berama Nishma, it is the very positive parak in Yirmiyahu speaking about the redemption of Klal Yisrael. And over there it says, V'inei yamim ba'imnu Hashem, zarati et Beit Yisrael, so there is a time coming, Hashem says, when I will plant, I will sow the house of Israel and the house of Yehudah with seed of men and seed of cattle. And Hashem says, just like I was persistent in making sure to uproot them and to pull them down and to overthrow them and destroy them and to bring them disaster, so too I will be persistent in helping them to rebuild and to plant, says Hashem. So you see here, this is the rebuilding of Klal Yisrael. It's clearly a positive nevuah. And the midrashic interpretation over here of Beima. So Rashi says over here, U'mekmina la b'masechet sota, lo kara v'lo shana, he didn't learn Torah, he didn't learn Mishnah, v'lo shimesh tamidei chachamim, he didn't service tamidei chachamim, alava ketuv u'mer, on him the pasuk says, zerati beit Yisrael zera adam v'zera beima, klomar, hachachamim, v'aburim, kulam, ezareim, lifrotam v'lirvotam. He says there that both the chachamim, who are the adam, and the burim, the ignoramuses, are going to be in the same category, that God's going to cause them to multiply. God's going to cause them to increase their numbers. So there, clearly, you're viewing the word Beima, again, in a negative light, even though it's juxtaposed to the Adam in the Pasuk. Hatam chachal kekra. Mar says, no, no, no. There, the Pasuk split them. Zer Adam luchud, v'zer Beima luchud. It comes before them, indicates that they're separate. In the case of Adam Beima toshi Hashem, the Yeshua is modifying both the Adam and the Behema. Over here, it says Zera Adam, Zera Behema. Each one is independent of each other. So even though they're juxtaposed to each other, the Adam has its own Zera, and the Behema has its own Zera, indicating that Behema is separate from Adam, not on the same level as Adam. Never we view Behema in a more negative light. Amar Rab Chanan, Amar Rab Yaakov, Bar Idiam Rab Yeshua ben Levi, Mishum Bar Kapara. Rabbi Gamliel, Ubeitino, Nimnu al Shchitat Kuti Vasrua. They came to a conclusion, they came to a psak halacha, that the shechita of a kuti is asur. So before we saw that there were different opinions about shechitat kuti, that the shechitat kuti was acceptable, or what made the shechita of a kuti acceptable. Over here we have a Beit Din coming and saying, across the board, shechitat kuti is problematic. Amalei Rabbi Zeira the Rabbi Yaakov Baridi, Shema lo Shema Rebbe, Elo B'Shein Yisrael Omeid El Gavav. So maybe this memra came in a situation when a Jew is not standing over the kuti. If you remember before, Abaye and Rava, when they discussed the kuti, Abaye required you to meet Omen al-Gabav literally, and Rava at least required you to say Benichnas, but he required supervision in order for it to be a good shechita. So what Rabbi Zera is suggesting over here is, maybe this memra that you're bringing is a memra that indicates that the Beit Din said that shechita of a kuti is no good, but nobody's supervising him. He says, Amalei, Dami Aymer Rabbanan, Kolo Gmiri Inshe Shmaitita. He says, this Chacham, Rabbi Zera, is as if he thinks that the Chachamim don't learn anything. B'she'en Yisrael Omeid Al Gabav, L'Memer Abayi? What do you need to tell me that? When a Jew is not supervising him, that's not something you need a Beit Din to come along and tell you that it's no good. We know that there's a problem with the Kuti, that he violates Lifnei Iver, Lo Tzitem Mikshol. So he doesn't have supervision, there's no way to guarantee that his shechita was a shechita kshera. So of course you need supervision. Or according to the Rashba, it's more fundamental in nature, which is, Abaye and Rava make it clear that a kuti is only permitted by Omeid al-Gabav. So there's no havamina by the case of Shein Omeid al-Gabav, because Ein Omeid al-Gabav is not even on the table. The only thing that's on the table is Omeid al-Gabav, and then if Rabbi Gamliel is going to reject something or say it's asur, it's clear that he's speaking about a case of Omeid al-Gabav. You don't need a shmaitata for Ein Omeid al-Gabav. So to have a Beit Din come along and say that a kuti shechita, when nobody is supervising him, is problematic, is so obvious. You don't need a shmaitata. You don't need a memra to tell you that. And that's what he's saying. You don't need Rabbi Chanan, Amar Rabbi Yaakov Yid, Amar Rabbi Shum and Levi, Mishur Bar Kapara, to tell you this information about something that is so obvious. So that's what he's saying. This Rabbi Zera makes it sound like that people don't know how to learn. They just say things willy-nilly that are not meaningful. That's just not true. The statement has to be a meaningful statement, and the only way it's a meaningful statement means that they are poselekuti even with supervision. So kablamine or lo kablamine. Rabbi Zera, after Rabbi Yaakov Bar Idi criticizes him and says that the member that we brought, it's clearly not about a case where there's no supervision, but a case with supervision. Did Rabbi Zera accept that answer? And then Rabbi Zera would also believe that Rabbi Gamil Beit Dino were saying a kuti that is supervised is also problematic in terms of their shechita. Tashma, damar Rabbi Gamliel Bar Yitzchak, amar Rabbi Asi, aniri iti Rabbi Yochanan shachal mishchitat kuti. So now we have a testimony from Rabbi Nachman Bar Yitzchak in the name of Rabbi Asi that he witnessed Rabbi Yochanan eating from a shechita of a kuti. Obviously we're assuming that it was Omer al Gabav, somebody was supervising him. Av Rabbi Asi achal mishchitat kuti. And not only Rabbi Asi telling us about Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Asi himself also ate mishchitat kuti. The Toiba Rabbi Zera. Rabbi Zera was questioning Lo Shmielu. Is it possible that they did not hear about this? Because did he have a Shmielu Avi Mikabli Lo? Had they heard about it, they would have accepted it. Odilma Shmielu Ovelo Kabloa. Or maybe they knew about it and they never accepted it. Hadar Pashat the Nafshe. So Rabbi Zera answered on his own behalf, and then he queried or he asked the question. Did they know about this conclusion of the Beit Din of Rabbi Gamliel? Mistavra the Shmielu Ovelo Kabloa. That they actually knew about it and they didn't accept it. Disakadakalo Shmielu. If you think they never heard about it, v'yav shmilu avim mekablila, and had they heard about it, they would have accepted it. Heichem istay milto lemechal isura. How could it be that a Kodesh Baruch Hu would have let a Talmid Chacham tzaddikim to eat something that is asur? Hashtabem tam shel tzaddikim in a Kodesh Baruch Hu mevi takala yadan. Here we know by the stories of animals of tzaddikim, Hashem doesn't allow them to consume things that are asurim. Tzaddikim atzman lo koshekein. Tzaddikim, certainly so, Hashem would protect them from Isurim. And so Rabbi Zera is saying that they clearly knew about the Isak of the Beit Din Rabbi Gamliel. Despite knowing about it, they rejected it. If you think that he never accepted that explanation of Rabbi Yaakov Bar Idi, then why is Rabbi Zera thinking in these terms? Lishnei lei, he could have just answered, Kan Kishrol Omeid Al Gabav. Kanji and Ishelo made al-Gabab. You could explain the difference between Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Asi in the following manner. Rabbi Gamliel's psak was a case where there was no supervision. The case of Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Asi, where they did eat from the kuti's items, was a case where there was supervision. And there would be no stira between them. Elalav shmamina kablamine shamamina. There it's clear that he accepted it from them, because had he not accepted it from them, he would have an answer to explain their behavior and say that Rabbi Gamliel's din was by no supervision. Rabbi Yochanan Rabbi Asi was a case of supervision. The fact that he thinks that there is a problem or stira between the two of the actions of Rabbi Yochanan Rabbi Asi and the psak of Rabbi Gamliel shows you that he thinks that they're both speaking the same case. And that must be a case of supervision. That means Rabbi Zera accepted Rabbi Yaakov Bar Idi's explanation or reading of that din of Rabbi Gamliel, that it references even to a case of supervision, that he thinks that a kuti is nifsal, and that everybody agrees that a kuti is nifsal. Clearly we have Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Asi disagreeing with that, and they don't accept this psak, or they don't think this psak was put together, but nevertheless, according to Rabbi Zera, there's clearly a problem, and that's why he believes Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Asi, we heard about it, and they rejected this memra and think that either it never happened, or they disagree fundamentally with the psak. Now, there are two things to discuss over here. We'll go in reverse order. The first of which is that the tzaddikim Hashem prevents them from doing sins. The Baal Tosfot over here, Tema, I have a list of cases in Shas where tzaddikim do problematic things, including Yehuda ben Tamai, Sherag Eid Zonim, he kills an Eid Zonim by accident or incorrectly, and we have list after list of Chachamim making mistakes and doing the wrong thing. So how do you explain that? Kodesh Baruch Hu doesn't allow any takala to happen on Yedei Tzadikim. So here the Ri says, and Tosfot says this in numerous places in Shas, that this principle only applies to the ingestion of Dvarim Shel Isur. And he says that is something that is mitamei li adam. It's something that is a significant violation. It's not external to the person. It's something that is internalized. Something that becomes part and parcel of the person. And therefore, eating Isur, or something that is Tamei, is so defiling that HaKadosh Baruch Hu protects the tzaddikim from something like that happening. And that's why the Gemara brings as the example Be'im Tam Shel Tzadikim, which was the chamor of Pinchas ben Yair, who refused to eat food that didn't have Trumot and Masro taken off of it, meaning it was Tevel. The Be'imah refused to eat it because, again, this idea that the ingestion of items Shel Yisur are problematic. Then Tosfot runs into problems because not everything in Shas fits into that. So then he says that it has to be something where the Yisur is inherent to the item, and not simply an item that's heter, but during Zman HaYisur. That's to be that an item that is inherently asur to eat, Hashem will protect Tzadikim from eating something that is treif. And that's what the Gemara is saying over here. How would it be that Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Asi hadn't heard about this Pesach of Rabbi Gamliel, and had they known about it, they would have desisted, and yet they still went ahead and did it? Okay, it was unintentional, they didn't know about it, but nevertheless, Hashem would protect them from ingesting something that was otherwise asur, according to the Beit Din of Rabbi Gamliel. And that's why Rabbi Zera concludes, it must be that they knew about the Pesach, and they rejected the Pesach. The last thing is to discuss Rabbi Gamliel Beit Dino. This is a problem that's not only true here, it comes up in one or two other places in Shas, as to which Rabbi Gamliel we are speaking about. That is because there are three Rabban Gamliels, and you have to identify which one of them that we're speaking about. There is Rabbi Gamliel HaZakein, who's the eldest Rabbi Gamliel. Rabbi Gamliel HaZakein is the grandson of Hillel. And he is the grandson of Hillel, he's also one of the Nisim. And then as you go down the line, they on and off generations, one generation is named Rabbi Gamliel, the next one is Rabbi Shimon. So we have numerous Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliels also in this situation. But right now we're discussing Rabbi Gamliel. So there's Rabbi Gamliel HaZakein, who is the grandson of Hillel HaZakein. There is his grandson, who is Rabbi Gamliel of Yavne, who is the peer of Rabbi Yoshua, Rabbi Eliezer, who is the Nasi after Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, post the Churban and the affairs that are immediately after the Churban HaBayit. Once Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai passes on, Rabbi Gamliel of Yavne takes over. And then Rabbi Gamliel has a son named Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Shimon has a son named Rabbi Yehuda or Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. So the grandson of that Rabbi Gamliel of Yavne is Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. And then Rabbi Yehuda Nasi has a son named Rabban Gamliel. And then Rabban Gamliel, the son of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, has a son named Rabbi Yehuda, who eventually takes over the Nasiut from him, and he's known as Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya, which also we bumped into in Avodah Zarah when they discussed the takanot of Pat and Yayin and Bishlakom. There we spoke about the Beitin of Rabbi Yehuda Nasiya, who's the grandson of Rabbi. So the question here, in terms of Rabban Gamliel, it would be to know which Rabban Gamliel we are speaking about. It's clear that we're not speaking about Rabbi Gamliel as a king. The only question is it Rabban Gamliel of Yavne, or is it Rabban Gamliel, the son of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi? Rashi over here says, Rabban Gamliel would be to know, b'no sh Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. Rashi claims that it was the third Rabban Gamliel, the son of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. Shamin achronim ubeitino nimnu ashchitat kuti lachar shishanit mishnatenu. And the reason Rashi gives it is because the Mishnah says that kuti is fine in terms of shchita. As Abayin Rova explained our Mishnah, kol shochatim, to reference to a kuti, which means that you have a stam Mishnah saying that shchitat kuti is fine, as well as the Braita that we had earlier that made it explicit that they thought shchitat kuti was fine. And this says that a kuti is no good. Well, Beit Din already had established that a kuti was no good. Why would Rabbi be rejecting the view of his grandfather, Rabbi Gamliel of Yavne? If it was already in place that kuti was rejected, why is Rabbi in the Mishnah saying that a kuti is fine? So Rashi says it must be that it's from Gamliel after Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, and that's why the Mishnah says it's okay. And now the Beit Din came to the conclusion that it was not okay, but that was post the Mishnah. Since it was post the Mishnah, that's why it's not included in the Mishnah. That's how Rashi reads it. And the Baal Tosef bring Perish Bakuntris. He says, "Umi ukasha." He says that it shouldn't have just said Stam Rabbi Gamliel. It should have said Rabbi Gamliel Benosh Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. Kidenan b'Masechet Avot. In Masechet Avot, in Perak Bet, it says Rabbi Gamliel Benosh Rabbi Yehuda Nasi Omer Yafet Amutarayim Derech Eretz. So when it quotes that Rabbi Gamliel, it includes his father's name to indicate to you or to tell you that it's this Rabbi Gamliel and not the Rabbi Gamliel of Yavne, who's the Stam Rabbi Gamliel in the Mishnah. This is in addition to that, it's a little strange that Rabbi Meir was Gozer al Yeinam, Yenam Shalakuti, Lo Gazal Shchita Deoraita. He's putting into place something that's a din derabbanan about their stam yenam of a kuti. Why didn't he deal with Shchita Deoraita? On the other hand, if it was Rabbi Gedolah of Yavne, it makes sense, because then that happened prior to the time of Rabbi Meir. So if it already was done or in place before the time of Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Meir deals with Yayin and not with Shchita. But if it was Rabbi Gamliel, the son of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, then that would be problematic. Why is Rabbi Meir only dealing with Yayin and not dealing with Shchita? So then the Dalai Tosfot says, well, if that's true that it was Rabbi Gamliel of Yavne, then he must hold Geri Emetim. He must hold that the Kutim are Geri Emet, otherwise there's no reason to put in a Gzeirah. You think the Geri Arayot, they're not Jews anyway. The Geri Emet, then you would have a reason to put it into place. So then he deals with other instances where we find Rabbi Amliel seemingly says that they were Geri Arayot according to Rashi. The Baal Tosfos would say, based on what we're saying now, that would not be the case. He would have to hold that they're Geri Emet, and would have to reinterpret that Gemara differently than Rashi. And he brings evidence to the fact that Rabbi Gamliel of Yavna believed that they were Geri Emet, just like Rabbi Meir did. And that's why they were metakein these items about the Kutim, because they were Geri Emet at one point. But then they lost their trustworthiness, they lost their integrity as Jews when they started to worship Avodah Zarah. And at that point, they rejected, first of all, Rabbi Gamliel of Yavna, their ability to do Shechita. And then afterwards, Rabbi Meir was Gozer El Yanam, that their Stam Yanam would be like that of a Goy. So Tosfot seems to favor viewing this Rabbi Gamliel Beit Yino to be Rabbi Gamliel of Yavne, because Rashi sees it as being Rabbi Gamliel, the son of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. Alright, we're going to stop here, four lines down on the top of Vav Amud Aleph.